welcome to another exciting episode of the Click Nation's Comic Book Chronicles. I'm your host, Tim D-O-double-G. And we have our regular hosts here tonight. First up, we have Dirt, a.k.a. PCN underscore Dirt from Twitter.
Hi, everybody.
And also from PopCultureNetwork.com. And we also have Agent underscore 70 from Twitter.
What's up, everybody?
And we also have at Roddy Cat on Twitter.
Hello, everybody.
And you may also notice we have another special guest here tonight on our 50th episode. None other than Glenn Brunswick, the writer of Image Comics Reality Check.
Hello.
Applause.
Real applause.
Exactly.
Not the applause in a can.
So we figured for our 50th episode, what better way to celebrate it than to have an actual guest on with us? And Glenn was appreciative to reach out and come on the show with us. So we appreciate that, of course.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, guys. I'm glad to be here with you.
You'll regret it later.
Sorry to hear that.
So, like I said, Glenn is the writer of Reality Check, which was a 4-issue limited series from Image that just ended a couple weeks ago. And he's also the writer of Non-Humans and Jersey Gods. So I guess first question would be, how did you come up for the idea of Reality Check?
Well, I do a lot of driving because I live in Los Angeles. And so I happen to be driving on the 405 freeway, which is like, you know, one of the nation's largest parking lots. And I was there for quite a while, not getting to my destination anytime soon. And I started thinking about, you know, what I wanted to work on and the idea that, you know, that I'm a writer. And I started thinking about, like, well, what would my life be like if one of my creations came to life, and what kind of havoc would that, create for me? And would it be a good thing? Would it be a bad thing? And basically by the time I got to my destination, I kind of had the core of this thing. And from there, you know, I was able to sort of like come up with the rest of it. So I definitely would recommend driving on the 405 if the creative life is something you want to do, because you get to spend a lot of time with yourself and figure out what you want to work on. So
now, when you're doing the driving, I always wondered this about writers. Did you keep like the pen and paper in the car with you so you could jot the ideas down before you forgot them?
I do some, you know, like I have like, I do have a pen and like envelopes, you know, mail, assorted mail in the car that I like scribble notes on and stuff like that. Sometimes I have the iPad in the car, and then I can just, you know, like when you can pull over, you can, you know, hopefully you remember your train of thought and you get the notes thing going and throw it down. But, yeah, so it's either like, you know, the iPad or you know, bits of toilet paper.
That would be for the times when you're in the restroom and the thoughts come to you.
Never know when inspiration strikes. I find a lot of my really good ideas come when I'm in the shower, because, you know, like my family is somewhere else and I'm like, you know, alone with my thoughts. And I find that like just like if I'm having any kind of problems whatsoever, figuring out like, you know, different sections or acts or whatever problems I'm having writing, if I get in the shower, I usually can, like, by the time the shower's over, I usually have like a kernel of something that gets me going. So that's how I deal with my writer's block.
Okay.
I just have a quick question about the tone of the book. One of the things that really struck me was just how funny it was and how lighthearted overall, even though it kind of deals with some, you know, deep issues, the loss of his brother and the, you know, the murder aspect and all that kind of stuff. Was there any point when you thought it might be a darker book and you decided to lean towards humor, or was humor always kind of the go-to with this story?
I think it's a pretty dark book. You know, I guess a lot of people have been like telling me that it's funny. And I don't know, I guess maybe just in my house, like the way like we always dealt with tragedy is through humor. So, I feel like there's some like, you know, real serious issues that Willard has to tackle. And from my perspective, it felt like I was writing a drama that had like comedy in it. You know, that was what I had in mind. And I know that, like, I mean, part of breaking a book is you have to sort of like, you know, give the log line and give a sense of like what type of book it is, whether it's going to be a comedy or not. And so, you know, with my premise, like, it sounds like a comedy. I realize that, but I always like envision the book as kind of a drama. So that's kind of like where you might have like the two different tones in the book, is because, you know, I just felt like the best stories are stories that take you somewhere dramatically. And I like to do that with humor. So I don't know. Does that answer your question?
Somewhere in there, I'm sure it does.
So do the any characters from the book are based off of anyone or any events?
I live in LA, so the book's set in LA, and I am a writer, and a lot of my views about about the comic book industry are revealed in insider baseball in terms of you know what being a writer in the comic book field is like is brought forth. But pretty much all the characters were just, you know, created. I didn't really like, I didn't base them on anyone in particular in my life or anything like that. So
gotcha. Let me jump in real quick. I guess we're assuming a lot of people already know what Reality Check are.
Oh yeah, sure.
What would you, for the uninformed, how would you describe Reality Check to them?
Well, Reality Check is about Willard Penn, who's a 26-year-old writer living in LA, who's like very, very driven to get his comic books going. He's been trying for like a number of years, just nose to the grind, like trying to make it. And he's had like some close calls with like Marvel and DC, but it hasn't like really worked out. Finally he comes up with this one idea that he thinks is perfect in terms of the marketplace. And it's this idea of sort of like this libidinal Batman, or Batman who's like more interested in satisfying
saving the hot chicks,
his urges than he is in sort of like meeting justice. So basically, like, he pitches this idea to a smaller independent company, and they love it, and they basically, you know, want to publish it. So, he's all excited, and it's great. But shortly thereafter, he has this like huge writer's block, and he can't figure out why. He can't remember anything about his story, and all his files are missing from his computer. And he discovers that his character has like come to life in the real world, and basically knocks on his window and says, "I'm not going back to that book until you help me find true love in the real world." And so he's a bit of an introvert, and he has to become his character's wingman, basically, to coax him back into the story. And that's the basic log line, I guess.
I liked how Will, you know, he based Dark Hour after Batman and Daredevil. I liked how, you know, they're all tragic figures, and Will, right, in his own way, sort of had that tragic background of the superheroes he grew up idolizing.
Right. Yeah. Well, all of these tropes sort of have been done before, and I think what's fun about it is the way sort of the characters react to, especially like Dark Hour. I had a lot of fun with him sort of like dealing with the fact that he is this conglomerate of sort of like different ideas thrown together, as opposed to sort of like, you know, he's upset that he's not an original idea and that he has to sort of deal with the fact that you know, that he's not really sure who he is because he's this conglomeration of things. So and the idea that like actually manifests as a real character in your life, I thought was kind of fun.
Nice.
Quick question. How do you pronounce the artist's last name? Is it Bogdanovich?
Bogdanovich. Victor Bogdanovich.
Yeah. I read in an interview you said that you were instantly drawn to his artwork when you saw it. What in particular do you think you know, he really brought to the title that added to the writing that you had in mind?
You know, Victor is first of all, I thought that his illustrations were just fantastic, and the detail was amazing. But you know, he has sort of like a Greg Capullo kind of influence, and a little bit of who am I thinking of? The Walking Dead, the first artist on The Walking Dead.
Tony Moore.
I'm drawing a blank again.
I'm Tony sorry. Moore.
Tony Moore. Yeah. So he has like those that kind of like sensibility, but more than that, like I just feel like his expression on the various characters really like gives you a sense of like what they're thinking, and I really felt like my story being dramatic and emotional, and comedic, as you said, like really like depends on those emotions coming forward in the expression of the individual characters. And he's just so fantastic with that. And storytelling really is his, you know, it's not about like creating these big splash pages. Storytelling really is his forte. And I was just really drawn to that. I thought that was the perfect combination for, you know, for the story. And, you know, I really couldn't imagine, you know, if I wind up doing another story arc, which I'm not sure we're going to do yet. But if we do wind up doing that, I couldn't imagine it with another artist. I mean, he's as much Reality Check as I am, as far as I'm concerned. I just think he's. I mean, what do you guys think?
His art reminds me a lot of Eric Larson's, actually. At least the action-y scenes of Dark Hour, sort of swinging through the
really?
City.
Really, you see Eric Larson there?
Yeah, a little bit. The way he sort of the way he composed the characters, and like at least during the action sequences.
Okay, all right. Well, that's interesting because I mean, when I think of Eric Larson, who I love, I think of like, you know, Kirby, Jack Kirby, and in a sense, like you know, Victor feels more like, as I said, more like, you know, Capullo, and so. You know, I kind of feel like they're like different sensibilities in a way, but yeah, I think he does action really well. So,
yeah.
Would you ever have any?
To me, he's like, you know, he's the complete package as an artist. So I couldn't be happier the way it worked out. And we actually have another project in mind that we're gonna think about doing sometime next year as well.
The project called what?
We haven't titled it yet, and I don't want to announce it quite yet because we haven't finished putting it together, but it's something that we're both really excited about.
Well, do know that when you do feel like you want to announce it, you have a place to do it here.
Absolutely.
Just saying.
Absolutely. It'll get out to so many people.
Yeah.
Would you ever have any interest of doing stories of Dark Hour in his comic book reality?
I haven't really thought about doing that. No, I kind of felt like, you know, his stories exist. You know, I feel like they're better when they're here, when they're in the real world, because, you know, I hadn't really thought, you know, I guess the book that reminds me of that kind of thing is like The Escapist is sort of like that. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, kind of the character as he's portrayed in Reality Check is he's kind of come out of the comic into the quote unquote real world. And
right.
he understands who he is. He kind of understands that he's from this other place. But then to go back, once he goes back into his comic book reality, so to speak, does he retain any memory of this particular adventure? And is that going to affect him? You know, would the ongoing stories of Dark Hour, you know, after he returns to his comic book world, be affected by what happens here? Or does he just go back in the comic and he forgets everything that happens?
No, these are memories. This is real for him. So, yeah, I mean, assuming we move forward, you know, and the comic moves forward, the comic within the comic moves forward. These are real memories for him, and he has a real relationship with his creator, you know, they remember what happened, and they're living within their comic book right now. But if we were to go on with this story, yeah, I mean, they could conceivably come back to our world and with the memories that they have, and maybe there are some additional things that we haven't even learned about those characters that relate to our main characters, you know, that we have yet to discover. So, just sort of like there could be more to them than I've told so far, but I don't know if there is yet because we haven't totally decided to continue the series yet. But we'll see what happens.
Right. I actually particularly enjoyed Devil Inside. I thought that was a great character name.
Thanks.
I wanted to ask where some of the inspiration for that character came from, and did you have any input in the visuals? Because I actually got I thought Bogdanovic had a real, who I actually confused with John Bogdanov, like an old, you know, Marvel artist from back in the day. But I thought the look for Devil Inside was really cool, and I wanted to know if you had any input on the visuals or the look of the character.
Well, I think I told him that I wanted some kind of like, you know, crazy Joker-esque type character. But you know, he showed me a few different pictures and I mean, this was the one that we decided on, in terms of the villain. And I mean, it just knocked me out when I saw it. So, it just was, you know, like he only had to show me that one picture once. And I was like, oh yeah, that's the guy. So, you know,
it seemed like you were having fun writing him. Did you prefer any one character over the other in this series?
Well, I mean, you know, the two main characters, I guess, the relationship, the dynamic between Will and Dark Hour, were the thing that I was like most focused on, that I, you know, I felt like in order to sort of like for the audience to suspend their disbelief, they really had to believe that relationship. And that was the core, thing that I thought about, that if they bought that relationship, then the rest of it kind of works. Cause then you're like, well, if you can believe that this character came in, then you can believe that his nemesis came in and, you know, and so that was really what I focused the bulk of my attention to in terms of, and so I guess, yeah, I guess that core relationship and those two characters are probably what I enjoyed the most.
Willard kind of gets a little, he gets on his soapbox a little bit about the state of the comic book marketplace right now.
Right.
Is this sort of a window or a flash into your thinking of how the current marketplace for comic books is and how it's constructed and what appeals to people?
Well, I mean, look, I think this is like more so than just, you know, more than just the comic book marketplace itself, but like writers in general generally want to sit down write what interests them, you know, that if they have an idea for something, they want to explore that regardless of marketplace. And I feel like, you know, there are certain expectations within the comic book marketplace that that you have to hit, and certain things that you just can't do. And so, you know, I think that part of the frustration for writers is, you know, like, it'd be great if, you know, you could just sort of like follow your muse and write whatever you wanted to, and then have an outlet to publish it. But you know, I mean, I think if you want to be successful as a writer, then you have to pay attention to the marketplace, and the marketplace is only going to publish certain things, you know, within various parameters. And you know, there are some things that are a bit different that manage to get through, but, you know, certain things you're just never going to see in comic book form because no one will buy it.
Of course. I mean, who thought a book about zombies would sell, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, I think when Walking Dead was when it first came out, I mean, nobody was thinking about zombies at all. So
not at all.
You know, now you know you can't cross the street without tripping over a zombie book.
Right. I was about to say, we all missed that boat.
What's that?
I said we all missed that boat.
Yeah. So.
Now
we just have to get into Robert Kirkman's boat.
That's right.
It's a big boat.
I was going to ask, were your previous projects, the Non-Humans and Jersey Gods, were those both Image books also?
Yes. Yeah. All the books that I've done were for Image. The first book I did actually was with John Romita Jr. It's called Gray Area. And that was how I started working for Image Comics. We're going to do that. We were going to do it with Marvel initially, and then the creator-owned
imprint
disbanded, and so Quesada actually, who was our editor, walked us over to Image and introduced us to those guys, and that's how I got to know them. And so from there, I just kept doing stuff at Image because I really like it there because you can do what you want to do. And you don't really have an editor and at the end of the day, it's you own the project. So, for a writer, who's interested in owning their own project, there's no better place.
Definitely. It seemed like there was a bit of catharsis on your part talking about the comic book industry, you know, in the first couple issues of the book. Was there any point where, as you're developing the story and thinking about these things that you're going to throw in about the industry, did you ever think, like, maybe I need to pull that out? Like, maybe I'm giving away too much, or I'm going to piss off the wrong person if I put this in the book, and then you got to pull that out of the story?
I don't think so. No, I mean, what I really wanted to do was sort of like give a real window into what I feel like if you're going to create a character, you want to take as much real stuff as you can take and throw it out there. And I don't know, I'm not that worried about, you know, I don't think there was anything in the book that was that anyone who is involved in the comic book industry doesn't already know, you know, I don't think there was anything necessarily revolutionary there. I just feel like, I was able to sort of create a character that, you know, really gives you a viewpoint of what, you know, working in the comic book industry is like. And so, you know, I hope I succeeded in that in doing, but again, that's not really what the book is about. It's about this dramatic relationship, but I thought this was like a good opportunity to throw out these things that, you know, that I know a little bit about. So
what are some of the books and even creators that you're a fan of right now?
Well, I really like Greg Rucka's Lazarus book. I'm really enjoying that book right now. I read the first first arc of Saga. I like Ryan Vaughan's work a lot. Trying to think, what else have I read recently? I don't know. Those are the two things that come to mind. I also of course really like Mark Waid's stuff. You know, the Daredevil book that he's doing is amazing, and I'll pretty much read anything.
As the crowd applause in the background.
So this is an old fashioned question. What did you grow up reading? What comics did you grow up reading?
Well, I grew up with, Spider-Man was my big, comic book addiction. You know, I was reading the, I remember reading the, when Gwen Stacy died, and, you know, John Romita Sr., books that he was doing were where I got my formal comic book education. And then, you know, the rest of the Marvel universe, I was kind of like a Marvel junkie, and I really got into Jack Kirby's work. And, obviously like in doing a book called, Jersey Gods, I'm like a big New Gods fan. And so, although I think that as a kid, I didn't really understand New Gods or really appreciate it. And I had to go back to it as, you know, college age guy and really, sort of like dig into it and
appreciate
it. I really appreciated Kirby's work. But I think that when I was younger, I was kind of missing that Stan Lee influence, that softener.
Absolutely, I can agree. I agree with that.
Yeah,
I had a similar experience with that. So,
yeah,
I don't go to that era. I can definitely understand trying to read and understand New Gods, you know, in collected format, and just not understanding it the first time around. So I definitely feel you on that.
Well, and what's worse is back then, like, you know, we'd get like the back issues, and you didn't always get all of them. And then of course, like it jumps around from the four different titles that he was doing. So, you know, if you just had the New Gods issues, you were missing like a big piece of the story too. So, I really like the way that DC reprinted them a few years ago, where they're like, you know, in the order that that Kirby actually did these books, and so you were able to read the whole thing in like, you know, one gulp in exactly the way that Jack was sort of like creating it. Made a lot more sense, and I really enjoyed it that way.
I'm just kind of curious, thinking along those lines of, you know, back in the day, comics were kind of this transient medium. If you didn't catch them when they were on the newsstand, they could probably disappear and you might not see them again unless you could track them down. Whereas nowadays, it seems like a lot of books are perpetually in paperback. You can go into Barnes & Noble, or you can go into a store and they can order them from Diamond. And now with Comixology and a lot of these places where you can just go online and buy them digitally from anywhere on the planet and just download them instantly, does that change storytelling for you at all with this idea that people can actually, if they happen to pick up number three, they can easily get one and two? You don't have to recap storyline like you may have had to do, you know, with the books where you were growing up, you know, or myself, I'm not calling anybody old. But, you know, they always had that page in the front that explained everything that was going on so you could catch up.
I feel you on that one too, Doug.
I mean, does that change storytelling for you, knowing that they're easily accessible like that?
I don't know if it really changes so much from a storyteller's perspective. I know that when I'm, like, researching something, if I want to look something up, it's obviously much easier to do. And in a lot of cases, I can just do it from my computer, you know, or do it, without, when I was younger, we were still able to get the back issues. You'd have to go to like a convention, you know. I grew up in New York City, and there were like monthly conventions at like the McAlpin Hotel on 34th Street. And,
what part of New York?
What's that?
What part of New York?
I grew up, the Upper West Side on 96th Street between Amsterdam and Columbus.
Oh, Upper West Side. Because I'm coming straight from Brooklyn, so.
Brooklyn. Okay. Well, Brooklyn was different, a different Brooklyn back then.
Definitely back then. Brooklyn was different 10 years ago than from what it is now.
Dude, Brooklyn is nice now, man. I mean, I'd even want to live there.
Hipsters be gone. Hipsters be gone. Anyway, I'm sorry to interrupt. As soon as I heard you say you grew up in New York, I had to jump in. Because everyone else is from, you know, from parts unknown. I represent Brooklyn all the time on the show.
You know, but you don't have a Brooklyn accent, I got to say. I don't hear,
I can, yo, I listen, I can turn it on anytime. You know?
We have all parts of the globe representing.
But you were asking, like, from a storytelling perspective. Yeah, I mean, I guess I don't really need to recap stuff the way although, I mean, frankly, like it's kind of like it's an annoying from a writer's point of view, it's an annoying thing to have to sort of, have like sort of like a recap page, if you will, at the beginning of because when I'm writing a story, I'm generally thinking about like the arc of the story, the five issues of the story, the four issues of the story. And I'm really trying to, like each page is like important real estate that you're really trying to think about building your story or expressing what your characters are thinking. And if you have to worry about catching people up at the third issue who didn't read the first issue, I don't know. I think that's a tough thing to do. And to do it well, especially now that even like the franchise characters are, you know, each arc is being collected, you know, into this sort of like trade paperback. It feels like it would be a waste for story. You know, I mean, maybe it's easier now for storytellers in that they don't have to do that thing. I'm kind of glad that I don't have to. Wow.
So let's talk about your writing process for a minute. Okay. How do you go about doing your books? Do you have the story first? I mean, you said earlier, you touched on, you have ideas for stories, you know, as you're driving or in the shower or what have you, but do you just go ahead and focus on outlining the whole story, or do you just start working on characters
first you have to like figure out like what, you know, like what's the hook of your story? What's your what if scenario? Like what is it that's new and different and interesting about your book? And then like, you know, who are the characters that populate that story, and who's your A story? Who's the character that we're mainly going to follow? And then what are the arcs of the character, the satellite characters around him? And, you know, you start to sort of build your story. And then, once I have that high concept and the idea that I think is kind of unique and some interesting characters, then I write the whole outline, from, you know, beginning to end. And really like, what works for me is if I can come up with like a really interesting ending right away, because it's easier for me to write towards an ending than it is for me to sort of create an ending that's interesting. So I really try and think of like, you know, when I have the idea, the next thing I try and think about is like, what's a really exciting way to end the thing? Like what's the revelation that the character is going to have? What's going to happen in the end? And that's kind of how I approached Reality Check. I had the what if concept, and then I came up with that ending, and then I wrote everything that was in between.
Mm-hmm. So let's skip one question real quick. Do you have any advice for, you know, budding writers? Because we have some in the audience and even on the show.
I have some really good advice actually.
Okay.
Run away.
What I would do is save up a little bit of money if you don't have like a trust fund, you know, and try and hook up with an artist that that is already working, that you know that the comic book companies will pay attention to, that they want to work with, and pay them to like draw your story, or, you know, like draw a portion of your story. And then the comic book companies will look at your thing. Like, you know, they're not going to look at a writer that hasn't done anything, but they will look at a writer that is hooked up with an artist that they care about. And if your story is good and is commercially viable, I think that, you know, they possibly will publish it or at least pay attention to you. So that's what I think that's, I mean, that's kind of what I did in a sense is, you know, I connected, you know, I got really lucky. I connected with John Romita Jr. And you know, obviously when you've got John Romita Jr., you can pretty much get a book published anywhere. So, you know, obviously that's not that easy for all writers to do, you know, but there's a variation of that model that I think would work. You know, you can find somebody who's good that people want to work with, that wants to work with you, that's excited about your idea. And so that's what I would focus on. I go to conventions or look up on DeviantArt or try and develop some relationships with artists who, you know, that are good, that are talented and that already are working.
Have you gone to many conventions recently, or do you plan on going into any recently if you haven't?
I think the next convention that I'll go to is probably WonderCon in Anaheim in April. And I'm probably going to go to San Diego in July and maybe a couple of others. I'm working with Will Spartaccio now on our second arc of Non-Humans. And depending on when we launch that book, we might try and launch it at a particular convention, but we haven't figured out exactly what month this year we're going to, launch the book yet. So as soon as we've got that figured out, I'll decide whether, you know, there are some other conventions that make sense for us. Okay.
Have you, if I'm reading this right, you co-wrote the story to Frequency, the movie starring Dennis Quaid?
Right. I didn't write the screenplay, but I co-wrote the story that the screenplay was based on. So, yeah.
And have you also done screenplays as well, right?
Yeah. Well, I wrote it a number of years ago. I wrote a screenplay that sold to Universal. It's like a relationship.
Ex Machina.
I'm sorry.
Was it Ex Machina?
No, that was a different. That's a that project. That was based on Brian Vaughn's comic that I wrote a screenplay for New Line a couple of years ago. But no, there was another project that I did a number of years ago that I sold to Universal, and so I did that, and then there was the Frequency thing, and then I've done some screenwriting, and then Ex Machina as well. So,
do you essentially write comics the same way that you write a movie screenplay? Is the idea that it's something visual, so you just pretty much do it the same way, or are you thinking differently in your head with the fact that it's going to be drawn as opposed to being acted out?
Yeah, it's a little different. Visually, like, you want to try and figure out the most exciting way to tell the story. So that part's kind of similar, but you know, obviously, a comic book is like, are these like frozen moments, and you're advancing the action through panels, and the reader is sort of like your companion in that he or she is filling in the gaps that you're leaving out, and you're trying to come up with frozen moments that really allow the reader to create that picture well in their head, because obviously you can't advance action in continuous fashion in the way that like you can with a screenplay. And so that's like the major difference, is that you sort of like really need to figure out where the height of those frozen moments are, so that you're not leaving out information that confuses the reader, and the reader is like sort of like working with you to provide the information that's missing.
When you take a book to Image, do you do all four issues completely and then hand it off to them? Or do you have like the first one done and then give them an outline of what 2, 3, and 4 are going to be? Or how does that process usually go about?
Well, with the first one with John Romita Jr., I had John Romita Jr. So I just kind of presented John, and that was good.
That helps.
Then I did a book called Killing Girl, with Frank Espinoza, who had done the book Ricketto. I don't know if you guys remember that book, but Ricketto was a big indie you know, really popular book, and Image published it. So they already knew him. And so again, I basically had an outline, and I said, and Frank Espinosa is going to be drawing it. And that was enough. I got the green light. And so I went ahead. And then with Jersey Gods, I found Dan McDade, and he worked up, I guess, maybe like 8 or 10 pages or something like that. And so I presented my outline with those 8 or 10 pages, I think, and that was enough. But again, you know, like Eric Stevenson kind of knew my work, and you know, I wasn't just like coming in blind. I think if he had never heard of me, you definitely need to have at least the full first issue. And if you have more than that, then, you know. So, I mean, again, it's like if you have a relationship with the company, things change. But, you know, I think when you don't know them, you definitely want to have that first book done, complete. Like, you want to have the art team in place. You want to have it colored and lettered, and so that they know exactly what that book's going to look like, I think. Yeah, I mean, again, it depends on – like everything in life, it depends on what your relationship is with the company.
Going back to writing for a second, do you keep stuff that you've written that think, well, this is not a good idea right now, so maybe I'll just shelve this later, or are you kind of like a fire and forget? Like once it's down on paper and it doesn't seem like it's work, or you may at some point get rid of it?
You mean like set fire to my computer kind of thing?
Yeah, you know, or just delete that file, or it's like, I don't know what, none of this is working. Just trash the whole thing.
I don't think you should delete any work that you've done or get rid of anything that you've done. I mean, you never know when you want to, like, you know, like, and nowadays, like, I think like in the old days when writers had like filing cabinets that were just eyesores and your wife was staring at it and going like, you got to get rid of that thing. I could understand, but nowadays, like, you know, if you write something on a computer, I mean, how much space does a computer file like really take for you to, you know, hang on to? And I think it's good to keep these things. And, you know, I find that there are, you know, like if I'm at a loss or, you know, I'm thinking of, or can't think of ideas that I need. And if I go back to some stuff that I wrote and felt like wasn't that bad, but wasn't quite there or wasn't quite, like you said, ready for the marketplace or so, you know, I don't see any reason to get rid of that stuff. And I mean, have you ever seen the Woody Allen documentary?
I know of it, but no, I haven't.
Well, it's worth watching because, you know, you really get to see he has these like note cards and like bits of paper, and they're like, you know, and when he's finished with the movie, he goes through his like trunk of stuff of like note cards, and, you know, like just kind of like reads one, puts it down, reads another, puts it down, crosses them off until he stumbles upon the one that like he thinks he can like really, you know, I was amazed because I thought like, you know, this guy's done so much stuff. I figured he just comes up with new stuff, but no, he's got like this trunk that he like, carries around.
Yeah, I have a notebook with a bunch of, right.
Every time.
Yeah, I have something like that myself. Have you had?
So, I have a question. Which one of you guys is writing right now?
I'm jotting ideas down. Put it that way. Trying to. In the very early stages.
Jotting ideas down. Okay.
Well, I have done not anything that I would care to. Anything about, but I have done some writing in the past, and you know, I kind of come across people every now and then. So, but has any like old notes come into your current writings, or any of your books in the past that didn't work at the time but came back?
Sure. I mean, well, like, I mean, think, you know, like I can't think of the precise example right now, mm-hmm. but well, you know, like one of the ideas that I've been working on that I'm thinking about doing maybe sometime next year has like a bit of like a coming of age story there. And I wrote the screenplay that I sold to Universal is this coming of age story. So yeah, I mean, there are elements in there that, that I'll look back at and I'll refer to, and the stories are totally different because that one takes place in the '40s and this one takes place in the present. But, you know, I mean, kids are kids and there's a lot of material that I wrote for that screenplay that never went into the screenplay that I can refer to and look at when it comes to that. So yeah, I mean, it's always good to have that stuff. When you look at it, you'll probably want to change things about it because I think you grow as a writer as time goes on and you continue to do it. But I think there are definitely things that that you can take from your old material that are worth saving.
You've definitely given us a lot of good advice that I know myself I'm going to take it to heart.
But, Tim, I'm ready to see some of your stuff, man. So
I'll hold you to that.
We pushing them.
Don't be surprised if you.
I'll be happy to look at it.
I was gonna say, don't be surprised if you see another email from me, maybe in 2014, asking for your eyes and ears.
Sure, I'll give you all the terrible advice that I've managed to manage. My ears in this point.
Well, we're not gonna hold you up any longer. I know you've got, like you said, the family and whatnot to get to.
It's dinner time.
That right. Too.
Yeah, that too. I gotta make some dinner here. So.
But we want to thank you for joining us on Comic Book Chronicles tonight. And before we do let you go, let people know where they can find you on various social networks and websites and whatnot.
Sure. Well, I'm on Facebook and Twitter at Glenn Brunswick. And that's basically
you need to get on more.
I do.
Some people find
you young fellas that know what this internet thing is can teach me a little. I'll plug in some advice on writing, and you can teach me about the internet.
You don't need any more distractions, I'm sure. That's all there are.
Well, gentlemen, I really appreciate your inviting me here. I had a lot of fun talking to you guys, and I wish you guys a ton of success. So.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming by.
So you can. I think you should just be able to hit the maybe close your tab or whatnot.
Okay. All right, I'm signing off now. Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Bye guys.
Have a good night.
Yay!
That was cool.
That went well. So again, cool. Thanks to Glenn for joining us. And like you said, follow him on Twitter at Glenn Brunswick. I've got that up on the website post for tonight's show already. So just go to dclicknation.com. And
he never spoke to them again.
He's gone like a ghost in the night.
He's like, what have I done?
And Dork Geekus, yes, I saw your tweet earlier. I just never had time to give him a shout out that, yeah, I'm assuming you have read his Jersey God, so.
He probably saw it, I would hope.
Yeah, he will see it since he had him in the tweet.
Yeah. Well, if you retweet that tweet, he'll see that tweet because he follows you on Twitter.
There you go.
Hey, it all works out in the end. All right, so now we'll get to the regular portion of the show.
We may
speed through. I was going to say, should we skip news or should we just go straight to reviews?
I could just touch through. I mean, if there's anything really, really pressing, but
yeah,
everybody picked two things. Comics to talk about, and that's it.
Yeah, two comics. That's all I read. But okay, news. We'll get the news first, and we'll kind of speak quickly. Go through this. Supposedly, Paul Rudd is in early talks to play Ant-Man.
No, I think that's been confirmed.
Well. On various headlines, it said confirmed.
Well, yeah.
When you click on to read the actual article, it said he's in talks.
Yeah.
Very early talks.
They're confirming that he's in talks.
That's right.
Yeah.
I mean, his name has been coming up pretty much the whole time, you know, him and one of the two other people. So it might as well be counted as a given.
Yeah. It's kind of like how the Bradley Cooper news came out.
Right.
All right. Let's see what else we got. So on Comic Book Resources, they had their what do you call it? I forget the name of the article. But the Axel in Charge.
Yeah.
And at least they went and aired part of it earlier this week where he spoke with Alonzo. Well, it was an interview with Alonzo, Fraction, and Soul talking about the writing switch on the Inhuman book. So you can go read that. And also,
it was nice to see that it wasn't like a. It was actually creative differences, and it wasn't like a hostile takeover or anything like that, or fallout. So it was kind of not comforting, but it's kind of refreshing to see that. Yeah, you know what? They did try to work it out, and you know, they're all still on good terms.
Yeah, I was gonna say that's one thing I saw was Matt Fraction. I don't remember if he tweeted it out or posted it, you know, somewhere, but basically said we're all friends. You know, we're all still going to work together in the future. Just this particular one didn't work out, and sometimes that happens.
Yeah, I mean, and he's writing for him now, so it's not like either one of them wants to kind of burn that bridge, seems like.
Right.
Okay. I have some more thoughts about that, but I'll save it for another time. Because it'll lead into more discussion, which we don't have time for.
Oh, shoot. So be on the lookout for Tim's next podcast where he rants, the solo rants.
It's funny, I used to rant a lot more than I do now, partly because I don't have the time. And if I actually want to work in this industry, I need to keep some of my
calm down.
You know what? That seems not to have stopped some of them, but yeah, some of them are in place.
They're already in place, so they can do that. Shia LaBeouf, he was in the news.
Yeah.
What a mess.
I ignored it the first day it was announced because I just didn't care. But it kept popping up so much that by the second day, I was like, okay, let me finally click one of these links and read what this is about.
So what's the 2 cents? Because I kind of ignored it too.
So basically, as the headline says, Shia LaBeouf steals Dan Clowes. I assume that's how you say it, comic book idea, and made it into a short film, and then he plagiarized something else when writing his apology. So he's a thief times infinity.
Basically stole a short comic book story and made it into a short film, and when people realized that he had stolen someone else's work, he just basically said, oh, I forgot to give the guy the proper credit for writing the story. And the guy who wrote it, Dan Clowes, was just basically like, it doesn't matter if you give me credit. You still don't have the right to do it.
He didn't get permission.
And then he writes an apology, and chunks of his apology are actually lifted from like Pablo Picasso quotes or something like that. So it's like even that wasn't original, and a lot of people are giving him crap for it.
So perhaps he didn't think somebody was – oh, crap.
I was going to say, people have gone back and – I guess he has some other comic book short stories he's done in the past too, and supposedly he's plagiarized from them in those also.
I was about to say, was he thinking that nobody was going to notice this or anything? Or I mean, with the apologies, it seems like, okay. Well, with the apologies, it seems like, all right, you caught me. So what? I'm going to do it again. I don't know.
But yeah, basically, people plagiarize because they don't want to get caught. Right. Or they think they're not going to get caught.
Or maybe he just thinks that because he's a big-time star, that he can just go ahead and steal somebody's work and make a movie out of it, and they'll just be like, oh my gosh, I can't believe that this great big Hollywood star is using my material that's so great for me, you know, when in fact they're just kind of like, you're from Transformers and that terrible Indiana Jones movie. In the studio.
Yeah. No one will notice. I'm a big movie star. No one knows I'm stealing from this comic book person. Yeah. Who reads comic books?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And let's see. Supposedly, Superior Spider-Man number 30 may or may not be the final issue of the series.
No, that's not. There's nothing about that. That's true.
It's just
the art. It could be. One of the things that's rumored is that there could be a new number one coming out to coincide with the new Amazing Spider-Man 2 movie.
Right.
Yes. And what else? Hawkeye number 15 was supposed to come out. Was it this month? Wait, what?
Yeah, this month.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was supposed to come out today, this week, I believe.
It
got pushed back to next week. So basically the same type of delays it's had before.
No, it's got to next month, I think.
Nothing to see here.
Yeah.
Moving on.
I'm going to skip down to Marvel exec Tom Brevoort defends renumbering.
Yeah, basically, someone did an interview with him, and they were asking, you know, why does Marvel seem so afraid to publish a book with more than 15 issues? You know, why do you always have to go back to number one all the time? And he basically says it's economics. I mean, if you think about it, every time we do a new number one, everybody buys it. And then after a couple of years, the sales drop off and we restart it at number one and everybody buys it again. It's just one of those things where, you know, numbering, continuing the numbering on and making it bigger and bigger is just something that really doesn't matter in the long run. And when you start over with a new number one, it lets people know, like, hey, now's the time to jump on the new, with a new creative team or a new story or something like that, which you could do in the middle of the run of a book, but making it a new number one just makes it clear to everybody out there that here's something different that they can pick up and try out. So he just basically says it makes a business sense, and holding on to those old numbers is just something that old fuddy-duddies do.
And we have breaking news.
Uh-oh.
Going back to the first article we talked about tonight. So Marvel has finally confirmed Paul Rudd as Ant-Man.
No way!
So
that's cool.
There you
confirmed
go.
Where?
Superhero Hype and Bleeding Cool both tweeted it out just a second ago.
Wow.
Yeah, there's a full press release, and I retweeted it. Marvel's Ant-Man has found its hero in Paul Rudd, who will star in the new film from director Edgar Wright hitting theaters July 31st, 2015. And then blah, 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 blah. Okay. So that's what we're always breaking news here on the Comic Book Chronicles, especially movie news on Thursday nights.
That's right.
Indeed.
When we're recording.
Best right. time. That one I just put in is probably not so much news, but somebody, if you want to put that in the show notes, it's somebody.
Yeah, we need to get to that eventually sometime.
Yeah.
I guess we can go ahead and say it since people be like, what are you talking
yeah,
about?
Right. What are you talking about? Yeah.
Yeah. Paul Dini said, he commented on Cartoon Network's programming decisions and why boy viewers are valued over girls. There's a nice IGN article you can go read. And he was also on the Fat Man on whatever Batman podcast.
Kevin Smith's podcast. Yeah,
whatever that thing's called. Yeah. Well, basically you can hear the whole transcript of what was discussed.
Basically, boys buy toys and girls don't, so therefore yeah. They want cartoons for boys and they don't care about girls.
Yep.
Girls are icky.
Yeah, plus there's the cootie factor.
Yeah. All right. So, now into the... like we're going to take Dirt's directive and pick two of the books you reviewed or read and discuss them. And if there's time, you can mention something else. Who would like to? We can do everyone. I can go one by one. So, Agent 70. Oh,
I was gonna say. Well, there's a couple books that look like several people read, so we can kind of jump through some of those first. Because I noticed, like Superior Spider-Man, a bunch of us had that listed on there, so we could talk about that. Just because we know everybody. Well, I don't know if Rodney.
Most everybody.
Yeah.
Not a majority. So, yeah, Superior Spider-Man number 24, which is one issue away from the double-sized 25th issue of the End of Darkest Hours. Of course, Spider-Man is still bugging out with the Venom symbiote.
Spider-Man bugging out, really?
I know how to play with words. Words with friends.
So basically, Spider-Man has stolen the Venom symbiote, and he believes that he is, smart enough, strong enough, has he's higher willpower, enough. Whatever, that he can control it. At the same time, you've got Green Goblin is really getting ready to pounce. He's cracking all of his secrets. And kind of laying the foundation for taking him out. And at the end of the book, the Avengers are being called in to bring Otto Octavius down. So we got a lot of stuff kind of building up to a big confrontation here.
I saw the Avengers. I was like, oh, yeah. As Jim Watts would say, business is about to pick up.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think this is going to start the downfall of Otto Octavius as Spider-Man?
No, because just like when you fought, I think how it's going to end is the Avengers will fight him. Somehow they'll get tear the Venom symbiote away from Spider-Man. He can use the symbiote as an excuse for his odd behavior.
Right.
At least while he's had it, while he's acting all psycho. And somehow someone else will end up with the symbiote. Because eventually we know that Venom's going to be in Guardians of the Galaxy. But they've been kind of teasing, well, we know it's Venom in there, but we don't know who's the symbiote. Because the symbiote can...
Oh, you mean who's the host?
Yeah, right. Who's the host. Because... You know, he can change its shape, so it may look like Agent Venom, but who's really under the costume?
It'll be Aunt May.
I would read that book.
Hey, she's been a herald.
I would too.
She's been a herald. Don't act like it couldn't happen.
That's right. Golden
was
oldie.
Was this nonsense?
You don't even know about that? Oh my goodness, we are dating ourselves, gentlemen.
Yeah.
Okay, what's another one everyone read? Trying to scroll through here. A couple of us read Uncanny Avengers 15. When I say a couple, me and Agent 70. So Uncanny Avengers 15, of course, it's the fallout from last issue, surprise deaths and whatnot. And we saw a couple cameos from a couple of mutants across the Marvel Universe. And it was mostly Captain America trying to take on the Apocalypse Twins, and also Thor and Wasp taking on Sentry, who was citing poetry the entire time. Which also reminded me why I don't like the Sentry as a character. Because he's annoying.
There's a lot of reasons why no one likes the Sentry. That's why his toy is still on the pegs and on the shelves in the conventions. But, you know, what I've liked about the last few issues of Uncanny Avengers, and I think we've mentioned this in the past, is that, you know, the story is really moving now. It's not nearly as static as it was. Now, you know, I don't know the last time I've seen, I believe it's a Celestial, spoiler alert, in a book, and, you know, seeing it appear, it was kind of like a wow moment for me, because it's just been so long. They haven't been used in a Marvel book in so long. I felt like, I mean, what was it? Wasn't there like a Dreaming Celestial in California or something like that? But other than that, we haven't seen one acting Celestial-like for a long time. So there's some things going on in Uncanny Avengers, and I'm looking forward to the next issue.
I'm ready for all the mutants to get raptured up to the Ark. I just want to see this mass of mutants, every possible mutant that can be in this book. I'm ready to see them all.
So you're primed for that graphic novel is that's coming out, talking about no more mutant, no more humans.
No more humanity, right?
Yeah.
Yes. Yes, I am. Okay.
It's interesting.
Let's see. Some other books. Let's see. I'll jump to pick. I guess you can pick another book, Dirt, from your long list here.
Oh my gosh.
Who do you want to shine the spotlight on?
Here, I'll lump the two Amazing Spider-Mans together. We got the 700.4 and the 0.5. 0.4 continued the story of him in the Black Lodge, the hospital that's built for supervillains, and I don't know. I thought it was okay, but it just seemed like it wrapped up in the most kind of basic way possible. The bad guys figure out who he is. They start to fight him. He busts out a wall. He runs away. The place catches on fire. Everyone kind of dissipates, and that's more or less the end of it. So, I mean, it was – I don't know. It's like it was a neat idea of having this hospital for supervillains, but I don't know. It just seemed like catching on fire and running out the window is just kind of wrapped it up a little too nicely. There's also a second story in the back. I believe it was this one where there's a little boy being bullied, and So he's trying to get the attention of Spider-Man to help him. He tells all his friends that Spider-Man's going to come and, you know, attack the bullies back. And so he's trying to get Spider-Man's attention, and Spider-Man ends up showing up the next day at school and teaches the kid basically how to hurl insults at the bullies so the bullies leave him alone, which I think nowadays if you start hurtling insults at the bullies, you're just going to get punched a little harder.
Yep.
Story just didn't quite work for me on that level. I think there were some problems with this issue overall. But I will say I enjoyed 700.5 a whole lot more. You know, point one and point two were one story. Point three and four were another story. And then five is its own standalone. And basically, in this story, Human Torch comes. He has a device that was brought to him by the Thing from the future. And basically, they have to keep it away from Reed Richards or the world is going to end. And so Spider-Man's got to help him, you know, keep this away from Reed. And Reed, of course, is interested in, like, well, what is this device and what does it do? And how am I going to destroy the world? So he wants to get his hands on it because he's curious. So they have to work together to try to keep it away from Reed Richards. And, you know, the ending of the story is the most out of left field ending I could have ever imagined for a story like this. And it was brilliant and perfect. And I loved everything about it. And I can't say anything because it'll ruin why it's so brilliant and works so well. But even if you don't buy any of the others, buy this point five, because this story stands alone and it is great. Like, this would probably be my pick of the week on this book.
I was going to ask.
Wow.
I might actually read it then, because it's funny, I'm a Spider-Man fan, but yet I haven't paid any attention to these .700 issues.
Yeah, and there really hasn't been much reason to. I mean, people kind of wanted to celebrate Peter Parker for whatever reason. There were 5 weeks in December, so they were going to make five books, and they forgot about the holidays, and it kind of messed everything up.
Mm-hmm. That's why we have two in the same week.
Yeah. But for whatever reason, this particular one, it's a completely different tone from the other stories. It's set apart from the other stories. And
it's probably the one that was supposed to fall during Christmas week or something like that.
Probably. You know? So it is a little more lighthearted, but I do love that idea of if Reed Richards gets his hands on this, it'll destroy the universe. And so Reed Richards goes, wow, that's crazy. I want to see it. Let me get my hands on it.
Yeah, I'm setting up a self-fulfilling prophecy at that point.
Yeah, yeah. So definitely check that one out.
Okay. Let's see. Agent 70, what would you like to pick from your stash?
Let me see. I'm gonna take a look at my list. Let me talk about one of the number one issues that I read this week. Ghost number one from who's publishing it nowadays? Is it Dark Horse?
Yes.
So I read this being somewhat familiar with the character from its previous incarnations, and it definitely jumps right into the story. There is a recap page to initiate the uninitiated into what the character is about, but they do sort of go into her origin. But it's basically right from the get-go, you get action and you get her mission. And yeah, I thought the book was pretty well done. The art is definitely attractive. The art is done by
Chris Sabella.
No, art by Ryan Sook.
Oh, say Ryan Sook.
Right. The story is by Kelly Sue. Right. The story is by Kelly Sue DeConnick and Chris Sabella. And
oh, he's a co-writer.
Right.
I see.
I got a question. Is this a existing character book?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, this is basically a relaunch.
Okay.
Ghost is didn't she originally appear as part of that World's Greatest Comics thing that Dark Horse did in the mid-90s where they had
the 16
different books? Yeah, she was part of that lineup, and then she's popped up a couple different times over the years.
Right. It's it's proven to be at least I want to say somewhat popular, but it just can't sustain – you know, a long, you know, a continuing series. So I don't know what their hopes are with this, if they want to, you know, to sustain a continuing series, or if they're just going to shoot to produce a limited series so that they can constantly, you know, reintroduce the character with number ones, a la Tom Brevoort.
Yeah.
But you know, it's I thought this was a well done book. Like I said, the art is definitely attractive. The story is engaging, and it made me want to come back for the second issue to see what happens next. So I don't know if it's my click of the week, but I definitely appreciated this book. Obviously, it's a number one. It's definitely a good jumping on point. But I would actually recommend this book just for anyone who's looking to try something new.
I'll give it a read. Also, because I'm enjoying, I know doesn't fit into the superhero corner of the Dark Horse books, but I do want to quickly mention how they announced today that their free comic book day offering would be a Project Black Sky book, tying in all their superhero books together in this large overarching type theme that's going to be running through Captain Midnight and Brain Boy and X2 and some other books I can't remember. The Occultists was one. So be on the lookout for that.
Yeah.
Free comic book day. And actually,
to do it.
That's I think that book is under the silver, whatever.
Silver level.
Yeah, silver level. So it'll depend on your store if you get it. But most of the time you can end up downloading the books on Comixology or whatever anyway, so.
Right.
So, Roddy Cat, your turn.
So, let me go ahead and pull out Black Science number 2. This book still continues to be slightly intriguing. It has, in cases, I shouldn't say that. I was going to say it seemed like it was a little predictable in a couple of cases, but it's not. This particular issue is pretty much focusing or starts to focus on one of the other characters as opposed to the main one. I believe is his name, not the main one, but the Ward.
Grant.
Grant is the main guy. Ward, who is pretty much like the bodyguard. There is more, I'm seeing more of a Lost in Space vibe and Sliders in this book, which is compelling to me. And you kind of get into more of the backstory of, you know, what happened, and you see some flashbacks to a couple of different things, the flashback to pretty much right when the book finishes, or when, not the book, the project they're working on finishes, and little arguments in between the guy who's back in it and Grant, you know, and then you just flash forward to what happens in the book, and Ward has to go out and find somebody because the main character is indisposed.
Okay.
So it's pretty good. It's a pretty good read.
It was on my list of books to try to read before the show, but didn't make it. But yes, I'm enjoying the series, at least issue one so far.
Yeah.
We've already talked about my two books for tonight, so I really don't have anything else to talk about. Yes. Let me go through y'all's and cherry pick something.
Yeah, actually, I was about to do that, if you don't mind. Dirt, Red 10, number 5.
Red 10, number 5. This is at its core, a mystery book. It's taking an old Agatha Christie story and basically making it center around superheroes, but it's a murder mystery. And all these superheroes are drawn to this island where they believe that the killer who killed one of the other heroes is going to be hiding out, but they find, in fact, that the villain that they went there to capture, he, in fact, is dead. And as they investigate, you know, trying to figure out what happened to him, all of these heroes are dying off one by one. And here in issue 5, this is a 10-issue series, so here in issue 5, things kind of take a turn. You start to learn some little nuggets of stuff that change the scope of the story and kind of change what your perceptions of what's been happening. Up until now, you've believed that the villain that they came to apprehend killed one of the other heroes. That's how the whole thing started. But you actually find out that another character was actually responsible for it. And so they came on kind of like this false pretense. Another thing that the book does is all of the characters here are somewhat analogs of characters that you've seen everywhere else. For instance, this guy on the front cover, he's like your Superman type character, except the way that they change his origin is kind of key to who he is as a character. Because you assume that, well, if he's the Superman guy, he's truth, justice, and the American way. But as it turns out, there's a lot more to his backstory than precisely that. And the book is not only playing on the ideas that the heroes have about themselves and each other, but it's also kind of playing on us as readers, because we see some of the characters on here who there's like a Wonder Woman analog, there's the Superman analog, there's Martian Manhunter analog, you know, and so you expect them to act a certain way and to have a certain history with each other, and then you're starting to find out that they've done that specifically so that you would assume that that's who they are, and in fact, that's not who they are at all. So I'm really kind of enjoying how it's playing with the reader, as well as at the same time this murder mystery is going on, and they're all kind of being played at the same time by whatever force this is that's killing them off. So good murder mystery, and it's one of those stories that runs a little deeper than your average comic book, and you do sometimes you'll run across something. Like in this issue, there are a couple things I ran across, and I was like, wait, what? And I had to go back to like issue 1 and 2 and kind of reread, because there were subtle things that I felt like I had missed because I was reading it casually, and then you do kind of get that payoff later.
Cool.
And it is a limited series, or a long limited series.
Yeah, 10 issues.
Okay. Right. And I know we talked about it before the show, but go ahead. This is the dirt portion of the show. The Illegitimates, number one of six.
Oh, yeah.
Let people know about another number one book.
Yeah, this book was a lot of fun. If you're a big James Bond fan, this is basically the James Bond universe.
Sold.
You've got this super spy who's traveled the world and has had decades of these special missions, and has a penchant for the ladies, we shall say. And as it turns out, he has fathered illegitimate children all over the globe.
He's Thanos.
So... that's why it's the illegitimates. It's his children from around the world. And it turns out that the government agency that has sent him on all of these missions has been keeping track of these children. And all of these children are exceptional. So the fact that this James Bond character has survived for so long and he's been successful at so many missions, there was something special about him. So they've been kind of tracking these kids and trying to find ways to kind of foster their abilities over the years, so that when a mission does go wrong and your James Bond character finally fails, then these kids are the fallback. And so now they're trying to recruit them and bring them together to try to stop the major villain who, it appears, has gotten away with his fiendish evil plans for taking over the world. So I just love – like, I'm a huge fan of the James Bond movies to begin with. So the fact that they're playing with that idea and bringing all of these missions together and these kids out of the woodwork. And there are lots and lots and lots and lots of little winks and nods to stuff in the James Bond universe. And they have flashbacks to some of his old missions, which you can kind of recognize from James Bond movies in the past and things like that. So it's a lot of fun.
And I should also mention that it's brought to you by one of the SNL cast members.
Yeah, that's what the PR said, but I haven't seen SNL in so long. I have no idea who it is.
The Killam. Last name, I forget the guy's first name. He might not even be on SNL anymore, but at least he was the last couple of years.
Mm. But definitely a good book.
We'll yeah, I'm gonna that out.
Give that a read.
Yeah, same here.
Anything else? Going once? Going twice? I think we might be done.
Oh, you
people.
Mean in terms of the review?
Yes.
In terms of the reviews?
Yeah, I think.
Yeah, I was about to say, unless we want to do Click of the Week.
Yeah, I can say it's Click of the Week time.
Okay.
Wait, listen, if anyone else has stuff to talk about, I'm actually going to pick a Click of the Week book that's not that I didn't even talk about yet. So
let's hear it.
Anybody else? Oh, we're going to start Click of the Week? So my Click of the Week is Indestructible Hulk number 17.inh. because I had a ton of fun reading this book. Apparently, what they're trying to do is foster, or at least further delve into the rivalry that exists between Bruce Banner as a scientist and all the other genius level intellects in the Marvel Universe. And it's illustrated as clear as day here how Bruce Banner feels when compared to the big brains, the fellow big brains like Stark and Hank McCoy and Reed Richards and Hank Pym. And the story basically kicks off, or the story gets rolling because Tony Stark, being his usual jerky Tony Stark self, starts prodding Bruce Banner. Why anyone would prod and poke at Bruce Banner is beyond me, you know. But when you're wearing an Iron Man suit, I guess you feel like you're, you know, what is it? What's his moniker? Invincible.
Invincible.
So exactly. So you can, you know, poking at someone who can become a giant green rage monster, I guess, is something he's not worried about. And of course, that gets the shenanigans started. The premise of the story is that Bruce Banner is trying to find a way to either contain or stop the spread of the Terrigen mists and the mutations that are coming that are befalling the people who have any hint of inhuman DNA in them. So Banner's trying to come up with a way to stop it. Almost stereotypically, he comes up with a bomb. And that just gets the other.
That works out well always.
Right, exactly. And then the genius level people are like, no, not another bomb. And everything starts from there. So I enjoyed this book. I had a lot of fun reading it. That's why it's my click of the week. And the art by, let me look up who the artist is.
It's Clay Mann, isn't it? It's two people.
Clay and Seth Mann. Yeah. So I guess they're related. And it's definitely a draw for the book.
Clay, so, I was just going to say
Mark Waid with another great story. What were you going to say? You were saying about Clay?
I was going to say he did the Gambit series that ended.
Right.
Part of what you said reminded me of what happened in Avengers Assemble this month. But go ahead, Tim.
I was going to say to piggyback off of Agent 70 and the Hulk, Indestructible Hulk. I will say my click of the week isn't actually a book that came out this week, but came out last week, because it would be the Indestructible Hulk Annual, which was done by I don't even want to butcher his name. He's the guy that's going to be doing the Wolverine and the X-Men art when it relaunches. He was doing the Ultimate X-Men that Dirt enjoys.
I know who you're talking about.
And who was the writer? Damn it, it was someone else. Anyway, it was a standalone story of Bruce Banner and Tony Stark, and it starts with them at like a convention when they're younger, listening to this guy give a speech about basically, you know, if you want your projects funded, you need to get into like the military type. Project.
The military industrial complex, yes.
Yeah, to get funding. And so then the guy basically grows up, he gets his funding, and he basically gets this whole island to himself, and he does like some crazy experiments on it, and now S.H.I.E.L.D. has to go investigate, and it's Tony and Bruce going to the island to sort of find out what's going on and stop the guy. It was really good.
It's Iron Man 3. Never mind. Anyway, never mind.
Wild. I'm going to look up who that writer was, but someone
Jeff
else can
Parker.
Go. Jeff Parker. Thank you. Who else wants to go?
Mark, click of the week.
Okay, here. Mine is Sugar Booger. Number. No, it's not.
No, really?
Jeez.
No, I'm going to go back to amazing 700.5.
Nice.
You got to read it. Even if you don't read the others, you got to read this one.
I will.
700.5. We'll be reading that.
Yes, absolutely.
And, you know, while you're there, you can pick up Sugar Booger number one.
With a name like that. And
or you can get the Wonderful World of Lisa Simpson came out this week.
Oh boy.
Was there any of the My Little Pony books from IDW?
There was. There was regular My Little Pony, and then there was a micro series featuring Luna.
I'm sure they sold well.
Actually, they do. They sell really well.
I say that sarcastically, but one thing Dirt has taught me on Comic Book Chronicles is people buy these little My Little Pony books.
You know, and it's funny because guys will come in and buy them, like, you know, males in their 20s will come in, but they usually come in alone. They talk very softly, and they try to make sure that no one's looking at them.
They're bronies.
They are.
All right. Did Roddy, did you give yours?
No, I didn't. And
tough decision.
Kind of, not really. I'll go ahead and say Black Science. It, like I said, it was a really intriguing read. I could say Avengers Assemble, but I would say 21 was better, was a way a little bit better than this one, even though this one was decent. But I'll just go ahead and say Black Science 2.
Okay. I am going to read that. It's funny, like, Avengers Assemble is one of those books I told myself I was going to stop reading, and then I kind of start back reading it again, and I've enjoyed at least the last issue with the Spider-Girl. I guess mostly because I've never read any Spider-Girl stories.
Yeah. Yeah, and I said I was probably going to pick this up for basically because of, well, partially from then I've been not so forced into reading it because of all the event tie-ins, but I was actually going to read it because of Gillespie writing it and then go back, but, you know, like I said, the last book was pretty good. I mean, yeah, the last issue was good. This one's all right, but this was just kind of cut and dry. There was a scene in there where, actually going back to what Agent 70 was talking about. So they're trying to track down the certain person, and Wolverine and Banner just happens to find them because they're looking for somebody else. So Banner gets into this car with the said person and starts asking questions because the person they're talking to knows who it is. It's basically Cashmere Venema, if you know who that is from. I think she was in Iron Man last or whatever. I can't remember what was last she was in. So start asking questions, and she had a henchman in there with him who was about to shoot him. And she was like, don't do that, fool. You know, clearly you don't know who this is. So you know, questions get asked. So what's that?
I pity the fool.
Yeah, basically. So questions get asked, everything goes well, and then they go in for a handshake, and the henchman goes and shoots Banner, and of course, comedy ensues after that. So that part was pretty good, but the book itself was a decent read. So, but I still go with Black Science too.
Okay. I guess that about wrap up tonight's show.
If you haven't already, Sandman number one is your 12th day, is on your 12th day free comic book thing at Comixology.
I better do
that. I actually want to give Sandman a try? You said Sandman, right? That's the
Sandman number one, yeah.
Neil Gaiman.
Yep.
Everyone says I need to read.
Yeah.
Or you could read Witchblade 171, huh? Huh?
Huh? Sure.
Is that the free one?
No.
So
I read about what happened in that one. I was kind of curious, but no.
I need to actually start trying to read some. What imprint is that?
Which blade is from Top Cow?
Top Cow. I need to start reading Top Cow stuff since they always have their Top Cow talent search every year. But I don't know any of their characters and whatnot, so I can never submit a story. that would help. And I'm downloading Sandman.
If it helps, they only have two real main. Well, I shouldn't say that. I don't know that much about them, but the two more known ones are Witchblade and the Darkness.
Yeah, but there's this whole whatever the artifacts and whatnot. I did a little tried to do a little research.
Yeah.
So make sure to go to the website theclicknation.com, where you can find previous episodes of the Comic Book Chronicles and comic book reviews, news. Make sure to follow the Twitter account at TheClickNation. Like the Facebook fan page, facebook.com/TheClickNation. Add us to your circles on Google+. Just search for TheClickNation and join the community, TheClickNation community. Subscribe on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. Just search for TheClickNation. and subscribe to the YouTube channel, youtube.com/theclicknation. And if you ever have any feedback you want to have read on a future show, send that on over to theclicknation@gmail.com. So once again, I want to thank our special guest, Glenn Brunswick, for joining us earlier tonight's show as we celebrate our 50th episode.
Woo!
Woo! Woo!
So there may not, more likely there won't be an episode next week because it's the Christmas week, and what is Christmas is on the Wednesday, right?
So right. New comics come out on Tuesday, so remember that. Go to your comic shop on Christmas Eve and get your comics.
Yep.
Right, because they need money to pay bills and buy Christmas gifts for their families.
Yeah, on Christmas Eve, right.
Sure. Oh, yeah, We'll pay the credit card bills afterwards.
Yeah. Rocket Girl number 2-3 comes out next week, doesn't it?
No.
Oh, okay.
I was going to say 2 came out not too long ago.
I thought I saw that somewhere.
I finally read it because I'm still catching up on stuff.
Or Voltron. Anyway.
Yeah, what are the big books out next week, Dirk?
Let's see. Next week you've got Robotech and Voltron. The crossover comes out. You've got Forever Evil number 4. You've got Just League of America 26. You've got Avengers. I've got sitting over here. Your Avengers 24 point now.
Now.
Point now.
Now.
And then
be reviewing more than likely.
And then The Saviors is coming out from IDW, and there was something else. Let's see, what else do we have?
Didn't you have The Saviors on your list for tonight?
I didn't.
I thought someone had it.
That wasn't me. Deceivers comes out next week. There's a Doctor Who special. And then the Wolverine Origin 2 number 1 comes out.
Ooh.
With the special cover. Yeah. So, and that's it. That's all for next week.
Cool. So, we want to wish everyone a Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays.
Merry Christmas.
Hanukkah, Festivus, and all that.
Yes, Festivus. Happy tidings, and we will see you whenever we record again.
In the new year.
In the new year.
Because we probably won't be recording on that New Year's week either. We'll see.
Wow, this is a long hiatus.
We'll see.
Reading in.
We'll check
Whoa.
Back in.
Oh, man.
Dirk shows off.
Change the call of the last prime.
Say something else.
Wow.
Nice.
We are the Comic Book Chronicles, and we are signing off.